It certainly did not star Batman or Spider-Man, who are apparently always welcome back. In honor of the mechanic resurrection, what is a sequel that no one asked for that turned out to be relatively enjoyable?
I am Matt Patches, and I am going to go with Dan Aykroyd's Blues Brothers sequel, Blues Brothers 2000, because damn it, the music is good. You get John Goodman, that's wonderful. No one asked for this, but that John the Revelator number is incredible.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I'm going with Resident Evil Afterlife, which should have just been as bad as the rest of the Resident Evil movies, but instead hit that sweet spot of so bad it's good with its video gaming nonsense.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I hope longtime listeners of the show and Operation Kino before this one will say it along with me, Transformers Dark of the Moon.
I hope they really did say it along with you.
I hope so. Hope someone out there.
Remember vulgar auteurism?
Yeah.
Ugh. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. This is episode 133 for Tuesday, August 23rd, 2016. Today, in 1962, the first live television broadcast from the U.S. to Europe happened via the Telstar satellite. And Dave and I were trying to figure out what exactly was broadcast from the U.S. to Europe. And I think I found it, Dave. It was a sneak peek of Chicago's Wrigley Field, a baseball game between the Phillies and the Cubs. So fuck sports. This is a terrible event. This has nothing to do with movies.
Well, that's the only reason that live TV needs to exist. So I completely understand because, you know, all the best TV is on things like Amazon these days.
We owe sports everything, including our reviews. David, do we have any new iTunes reviews this week?
We do. I hope they're not reviewing
their Olympic
theme. Because that segue was pretty grim. But we have a couple, none of which are as long as the one I read last week, if you remember that. So we can plow through a few of them here. The Patman 23 gives us 4 stars and says the 5th star is being withheld for self-serving reasons. Although this podcast is clearly a 5-star effort, I'm rating it at a 4 and holding the 5th star hostage for ridiculous reasons. Although I enjoy the entire podcast a great deal, I'm particularly fond of David reading the reviews. Years ago, I left a review and it was never read. Some months ago, motivated by the cast urging listeners to leave written reviews, I updated my review in the hopes of hearing it, but my joy never came. Since quite possible that both my reviews were lost in the shuffle, or if they were read, I somehow missed the episodes, or, more likely, that my rambling prose was just unacceptable. But I have your 5th star hostage regardless, and will allocate it appropriately after I hear this review read and I experience a brief moment of joy. Should you not read this review, I will most likely eventually change my damning 4-star review to a 5-star, because your podcast is that great and I'm sure I can't stay mad at you. Well, thank you, the Patman23. Get on that update.
We do not need Liam Neeson to go free the hostage star. Thank God.
We earned it, like Super Mario 64.
2 more quick ones. 1, new big fan by CCC3K. I just came across this podcast midway through the Game of Thrones season. I've read most of your writings for years now, but I guess I never put the pieces together to find this podcast. I've become a huge fan of the show. Each of you have great and dynamic points of view, from the pretentious David, capitalized the way Donald Trump does, to the wonderful female views of Joanna and Katie. I motion to make Katie a full-time host along with the rest of you.
Wouldn't that be great?
Let me finish this review and then I'll get back to that note. I love each of you and your varying views. Keep up the awesome work. Casey Carroll in Nashville at not KCC. Well, Casey, I have very good news for you. Katie actually is a full-time host of the podcast. She is actually just on maternity leave right now. She just had her first child.
Full-time host of a baby.
I just met the baby. Oh. The first podcast baby yesterday. He's adorable. Katie, I read this review to Katie. She laughed. She was hoping to return shortly. So, good news. And finally, the film cynic, our friend, the film
an old-time
cynic,
friend.
Find himself shouting back, the remake. wipe my review slate clean, which I guess you can do. I hated the idea of podcasts before I discovered this one. Well, the old incarnation of this one. I had just had my first kid and needed something interesting to listen to while I walked him around the neighborhood, so I gave this a chance, since all the hosts had been acquaintances when I lived in New York and I was kind of homesick. My son recently turned 4, and so I guess I've been hooked for a while. I still only ever get into one other podcast. It's You Must Remember This. If I don't include Storm of Spoilers and other Fighting in the War Room feed staples, I actually have gotten to the point where I'm frustrated with at least one of you each week, and it goes around and around. But that's what I love about it. I agree with each of you sometimes, and disagree with each of you other times. When I began, I agree with Patches a lot more, I'll say that much. We've all evolved together, only it's not that two-sided, I guess. I still yell at the phone or car sometimes, or simply participate in the discussion without you hearing me. Car radio, I should say. He doesn't yell at his car. I mainly wanted to chime in directly this time, because as I said, my son is now 4, and I had another kid since starting 2. And I just wanted to say that after hearing your recent segment on children's programming, I can't wait for you all to discover what craziness kids are actually watching these days. Did you know that Teletubbies is back? Have you ever even heard of Bubble Guppies? The Odd Squad is great, though. You should do an Odd Squad podcast for kids. It reminds me of Pete and Pete. Okay, fine. I have to give you guys classifications, right? Patches is Paw Patrol. Dave 7 is PJ Masks. Katie is Sesame Street. David is Canimals. Joanna is Word Girl. Thank you, the film cynic, a.k.a. Chris.
My God. There is a lot of children's television we do not watch.
No, all my friends have kids that fall on either side of the gap of 4, so I guess I have stuff to look forward to.
And bubbly, smiley. I heard they just rebooted the Teletubbies. That's what Campbell was saying. Oh, my God, yeah, good. The world's changing.
Can the purple one be openly gay this time?
It's a new world.
Or the brave new world?
It's a new world, but the smiling sun is probably still a white child smiling down on the world, and it's just all messed up. Anyway, I thought Chris made a great point in his review. He cleaned the slate of his previous review and updated it and left something new. I have no idea if that helps iTunes-wise. Probably does. Leave a new rating. But we've been doing this for a very long time, so I can only imagine what thoughts you had if you left a review 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, and you want to leave a new one. I think that's great. We would definitely want to read them.
Yeah, but let's be reasonable. It's enough for people to leave us one review, and we are greatly appreciative of that. If you left a review, maybe
I'm not asking too much here.
They can leave another one, but
I'm checking in with the people.
If you haven't left a review. Or if you want simply to make me read literally anything Ron Burgundy style, this is the way to do it.
So yes, leave some reviews and on with the show.
I'm going down. 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 On you. I'm breathing deep and I leap and I'm going under like eating that visa key to how we could beat global hunger, achieve total peace on earth.
We're doing a lot of summer wrap up in this episode. Not too much of August left. Well, what movies, David, you see everything. So is there anything else coming out this summer that people need to make room for? There's the
when do you think the summer is over?
The summer must have been over in July this year, or the movies have not been good.
Labor Day.
I am a pretty big fan of this movie, White Girl, which is opening on September 2nd. So I guess that might squeak in. I've yet to see The Light Between Oceans. I've heard, well, I guess it's embargoed, so I can't say. But I haven't seen it myself, but I've heard many things.
I don't consider September 2nd. We're entering a new phase, although okay, September good. Is kind of a weird limbo for
I go to Telluride next season. Week. I'm already neck deep in festival screenings. So for me, for us, for you out there, when you're listening to this show, the summer is over.
And coming this week are movies we're not going to review, such as Mechanic Resurrection and Don't Breathe. Nope. Actually, a horror movie that I'm interested to see from the director of the Evil Dead remake. Looks fun, but we're not going to get to that. So we're kind of looking back at the summer this week, and one stat caught my eye that I wanted to bounce off you guys. Our colleague Mark Harris, who is a writer for, he wrote for Grantland, Vulture. He was an EW guy for a long time, has written many books. We've talked about his amazing book, Five Came Back, on this podcast. He made a note over the weekend that caught my eye. He's very keen to what original movies make the top box office of every year, especially the summer. And he mentioned that 2016's five top grossers that weren't animated, sequels, or adaptations include Central Intelligence, Bad Moms, The Boss, Lights Out, and The Shallows. And if that's what the original offerings are, that can look grim to some, and especially the people who follow Mark were kind of like, oh my God, you know, originality in Hollywood is dead. It's all superhero movies, action, bombast, it's boring. And, you know, Mark's takeaway was he made some good points, which was, you know, the live action original film is such a marginal idea at this point. But the people who do get to make them are women or people of color. They're modestly budgeted, which is what we're always looking for. So some of these films exist, but they're not really a priority for the studios that are pumping out big, big, big movies during the summer. And he kind of swiped at them, calling the, you know, if you were a mid-level studio executive and you want to develop something from scratch, you're basically, there's no way. You have to be a quote-unquote property manager at this point, which I raised an eyebrow at him as someone who is a, you know, Mark knows everything about golden age Hollywood. And I just think that property managing is what we've been doing throughout the entire history of Hollywood, from stars, star contracts, and pushing movies out. You know, we need another Bible epic because that's what's hot right now. That's kind of what we've been doing.
Just simple
forever.
As just tell a good story, we would have gotten there at some point.
Right. Show business. It'll always be a business. But what I want to do, turn to you guys, is just what is your takeaway when you hear that the box office isn't full of original movies, or you have to go so far down the list to finally get to one of these? Central Intelligence is the 13th biggest movie of the year. It's made $127 million, which is damn good for a comedy starring The Rock and Kevin Hart. But, you know, it's all sequels from the top up. But is that something that's really suspect here? Is this a bad thing? Should all the people who are kind of rolling their eyes and griping to the box office analysts, do they have a point, or are they kind of missing the point? So what do you guys think, David or Dave?
Well, my initial reaction that I haven't probed much deeper is that they do have a point. I think that when you think about, you know, what you're saying about brand properties always leading the way, goes back to the early star era. I mean, it goes back to the 20s and before. It goes back to when movie stars were known not by their names, but by their descriptions, curly-haired girl and whatnot. And that was sort of the property that people were chasing. But I do think that when you think back to the 90s, the 80s, when we were growing up, of course, before then, You don't have to look any further than the list of the year's best highest grossing films, and you don't have to think any harder than remembering what it is that you saw when you were a kid to know that it's a disgusting anomaly that or simply a new way of Hollywood existing, that so few original films, even if you use original in scare quotes, are making a dent or coming out or live action in that way. You know, like it's terrifying. And I watched, I mean, it's all part and parcel of the same thing, the digital revolution and everything else like that. But I saw a Toronto film this morning that will go unnamed. It's not that exciting. You wouldn't even care if you didn't know what it was. But I was watching this movie, which was perfectly fine, and thinking to myself, how will this movie ever get seen? It's going to open VOD one day, maybe at the IFC Center or something like that. But, like, once upon a time, this could have been a movie that could, why not open on a few hundred or a thousand screens?
But should
why
it?
Not compete? Sure. I mean, we should live in a world where it's a little bit, where, like, that idea is remotely feasible, where it doesn't seem from the moment that you roll on your first take that you sort of know what its ultimate destiny is going to be. But
you don't even like it that much. That's what's weird. You're defending it even though you're kind of... It sounds like you're ho-hum on it, but you think that it just deserves it.
The quality of the movie is irrelevant. I think that I would like to live in a world where these movies... I mean, the quality of many of the movies that I miss being in theaters and having outlets for release were much, much worse than the movie I saw today. And in some cases, that was part of their charm. But, you know, we lived in a world where they could take chances. They did take chances where you didn't need to. I mean, we've had this conversation in many different forms.
Yeah.
But like, you didn't need to have a $100 million movie in order to that had a 8 different cross promotional deals and tied into a greater cinematic universe in order to earn the screens and the marketing push that required to get them there.
So that's what I'm really interested in. Do these movies need these budgets? Because people with technology today obviously can tell stories of any size and shape. I mean, truly, scope doesn't seem to be a factor anymore when you have the array of technology that we have that allows people to tell stories. It's maybe that the stories don't kind of live up to that promise. And I posed to you guys an email before this that I'm always curious, have we found the godfather of independent film? Have we seen something so great that it really convinces us that we don't need mid-level budget features anymore? Like, I don't understand why people raise an eyebrow when $100 million movies that open in 4,000 screens that are destined to be in the top 10 of our box office, like, why do we want a drama in there? Does that give us hope for something? Or does that mean we're allocating the money to make that movie bigger? Or are our visions not being met for great stories because they can't get the budgets of these massive movies? Why aren't the indies, like, why aren't we satisfied with what independent film can do or modestly budgeted film can do? Why do we need movies in the top 10 of a box office to feel satisfied?
Well, but it's not that we need these Sundance movies to be in the top 10, but it's what the top 10 indicates to us. I mean, the top 10 are not these extreme outliers. They're sending us a clear message that these are the movies making money, and Hollywood, you know, in the tentpole model that they're chasing, no longer has the resources or the interest to put anything under the tent. I mean, these, once upon a time, we were okay with these movies sort of morally because of what they allowed for. Even you make Spider-Man High School and you can pay for a Manchester by the Sea. But now, because of the
Dave just died a little inside when you called it Spider-Man High School.
Yeah, Spider-Man High School is going to be great.
I know it's called Spider-Man Homecoming. I don't give a shit. Fuck you. Fuck all this shit. I'm so sick of it.
Someone needs to go to prom.
I saw Tom Holland smoking outside of my office today, even though I could have sworn he was in Atlanta. I think I'm just seeing things. I got Spider-Man High School in the brain. But the... it's just so... We're not supporting the medium. We're not making it economically viable. I don't understand why people, as the cinema reverts to the spectacle from whence it came, maybe completing that life cycle where, you know, only these giant things that can't be made on a smaller scale are driving people to the theater, why we have made it such a zero-sum game. Why studios aren't more interested in doing what they do for a few months of the year at the very end and making $20 million movies that can afford to pull in $25 million and turn a profit even with the marketing factored in because of the ancillary markets, because of international stuff, because of going into libraries and whatnot. I don't know why people aren't interested in playing the margins anymore. It seems like there's money to be made there even as we shift towards VOD. It's sort of mind-blowing. I don't know,
looking at these tweets that we're talking about, the top 5 grossers, and I maybe want to see 2, but haven't seen any. So if we're just having a based on that, I think we're just having a conversation about markets, not so much about quality. We're asking, you know, we're in a swing period. Why aren't there more, you know, mid-budget things? But I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. There's a lot of it, like when you say that you know, even transitioning to VOD, you think there's room for these spaces, you think that there's, you know, still a financial way to make sense to get a movie distributed like beyond New York and LA.
Say that again.
So, like, you have a mid-budget indie, and you get it distributed in New York and L.A., like, going beyond that is a pretty much a big leap without, like, a major company behind you. That
yeah, they, you know, and they'll try to, you'll see in cases like Indignation or Don't Think Twice, they successful New York, L.A. releases, they will try to platform to these other major markets, and they have not met with so much success. A lot of the time because, and this is another major factor that can't be overlooked when having this kind of conversation, young audiences aren't really going to the movies anymore, and that's why movies like Grandma, or I'll See You in, not Grandma, what the fuck was it called? Well, there was a movie, Grandma.
There was a Grandma.
I'll See You in My Dreams. Movies like this that cater to an audience that doesn't know how to, isn't as comfortable with streaming, certainly not as comfortable torrenting, those are the people who are still reliably going to the movies. Indignation, a Philip Roth adaptation, that makes sense. Mike Birbiglia making a big show out of Don't Think Twice, that drove people for its opening weekend. But the younger audience is a factor.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I guess my point would be is if we're talking about, I don't see in these top five original things, like, necessarily something that interests me. And I know that, you know, if I jump into VOD or a curated streaming service, that I'm going to find something that interests me. So maybe this just isn't the forum for it right now. But what we do have in these mid-budget things is, like, a little bit more representation, because that seems to be the profitable... Well, mid-representation and horror. But, like, those two things seem to be the things that could still function in a studio setting, because it's tapping into horror market, which will show up for really cheap movies, and people that, like, haven't seen themselves on screen reliably now, you know, get to plumb the, you know, weird buddy comedies that all the white people got to do in the late 80s and early 90s.
Right. And blowing them up, that's what I don't get. I don't see the point for, you know, pushing these mid-level movies and demanding them having $100 million budgets. So, like, why are these not in the top five? That it feels more like a cry for studios to invest more than the audience is failing to show up for them or having the diversity in their own choices to
Well, you said
these
Central
movies.
Intelligence made over $100 yeah. million dollars, so, like, that's respectable in whatever time Huge. Period you put it in, and that's, you know, that's a good investment. Well, they're not making as many, but I think that's just a swing that we see because of, you know, superheroes happening and, like, the smaller studios that used to do, you know, couple $20-30 million pictures, like
right.
Focus Features or something, got shuttered up and nothing's
well,
coming
Focus
to replace
Features Warped. Fired yeah. they fired James Sheamus because he wasn't thinking along those lines, even though the company turned a profit every year. They weren't
more
the fences right. the way that they wanted him to, and I
right.
really
I think
paid the price for it. But Central Intelligence, it's important to note, has grossed worldwide $210 million. The most important detail is that it cost $50 million. So double the budget to factor in the price of getting the movie out there. It's $100 million. You're still sitting on $110 million of money that could be distributed for profit. So, like, that is a bona fide success.
Right. Well, I think the interesting thing is that, as opposed to when we've previously had these conversations about how the industry is turning, is I think this one's entirely about markets. So I don't think any of us is necessarily wrong. I'm just not sure I'm going to feel passionate about it when I did enjoy things
right.
primarily on the animated side of 2016's releases.
Yeah, I feel bad putting animation in that chastising category. Well, the one thing I'd to wrap up here, I'd ask you if there are movies that seem to deserve the budget of these big movies, deserve 3,000 screens. Like, what movie needs to be this size to compete? Like, are there movies that you've seen in the past? I'm thinking, like, 90s dramas or even early 2000s dramas that had the backing of a studio where you'd like to see more of those type of movies. These movies that, if they played big enough, they would make the top 10. The only movies I can think of, really, are not movies I want to see, which are Clint Eastwood movies, like American Sniper.
Well, I mean, you guys are talking about dramas, but we started off...
I feel like that's podcast. What most people talk about when they talk about where are the original movies that could break into the top 10. They're talking about...
No, we were... I mean, we started Operation Kino really early on, was talking about we had a spring of a whole bunch of original sci-fi movies that was like the Limitless and the Source Code, if you were. So if you're going to ask my personal opinion... They're all going to be genre fair because I still think you could sneak in, you know, a Babadook and still have something great. But not
maybe Arrival will fill that void for you.
Possibly. They look like the giant floating heads from Rick and Morty, so I have to get past that first.
Oh, that's Zardoz. What's wrong with you? David, anything come to mind?
No, I long for another time. I don't know. I'm thinking that, like, more and more as the bot in the middle falls out and the stratification grows and you have movies that cost $250 million and movies that cost $500,000, we're not, like, at a certain point, we're not even talking about the same medium anymore. Like, it's going to potentially reach a point where it's like, I'm not comfortable with even calling Spider-Man High School 4 a movie because it's not a movie. Like, that's not, should not be in the same purview of writing about that as it is about writing whatever's playing at Sundance. Like, they're so genetically commercially different.
And then John Watts was in one pool, and now he's in a different pool.
Well, it's only Spider-Man High School 3, because he was in college and the other.
It won't be impossible to leapfrog from one to the other, but if you think of it like a Stretch Armstrong trying to be in the middle and keep one arm on each side, eventually the two modes of filmmaking are going to move so far apart that the toy breaks and the rubber
shit flies
everywhere. Let's just
get robots to direct all the big blockbusters. Let's get Sonny from iRobot to direct big blockbusters.
Wait. What happened to Stretch Armstrong?
They were trying to make that into a movie. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. What happened to that? We're getting a Clue remake? I haven't gotten my Stretch Armstrong movie
yet.
No,
you get the Max Steel movie, which looks just a cut above direct to DVD. If the
sure
Chinese
Max
dub
Landis,
trailer...
Max Landis will write you some Stretch Armstrong movie next year. Don't worry about
it. Oh, boy. All right, on to the next topic.
Scivola, scivola la mia memoria, nebbia e fantasmi, antica storia.
All right, for this week's mini segment, I asked you guys to rattle off some summer superlatives. Let's be very positive here. Well, one of them is negative, but mostly positive about summer movies, things that we actually dug, very specific things. I'm not even going to ask you what your favorite summer movie was, unless you know it off the top of your head. Anyone?
There were a couple good ones. We did an IndieWire critics survey this week, polling critics saying the best movies. Yeah. And there were like a number of responses where I was like, yeah, that was a really good movie.
There's
depending
hope.
On when you're... What was that?
I said there's hope in this world.
Yeah, I mean, between Kubo and Beach Dragon and A Bigger Splash and Indignation and Swiss Army Man, like there were a few winners out there.
Well, let me...
I also saw Creative Control this summer, but I have no idea where you guys... When and if you guys got a chance.
I think that was early.
That was early.
Out of the... Sorry. Where did you see it? Amazon? I think it's streaming now.
No, they actually did a showing of it here in our independent theater, the SIE Film Center in Denver.
You're arty.
Yeah, that's right.
Let me ask you guys... What was the best summer movie performance for you guys? Dave or David, what do you think? What was the best summer
movie? I'm going to step in with the Daniel Radcliffe farting corpse movie because that dude can really do that thing with his eye. And I don't know how much of it's built out of editing and how much of it is built out of score, but I was very impressed throughout the whole thing. Because even though Paul Dano was doing something that I've seen him do before, Daniel Radcliffe was doing something completely new. I love that movie, but
I was just about to say Paul Dano doesn't get the credit he deserves in that movie.
Which, I mean, the movie's great, sure,
excellent. And I also think that Daniel Radcliffe in a movie that many, many fewer people will ever see or talk about was also very good. More recently, as an undercover neo-Nazi in a movie called Imperium.
It just came out.
I believe it's on VOD. So if you liked Daniel Radcliffe and you want to see him continuing to take bold chances and stick the landing, Imperium not going to change your life, but he's very good in it.
Yeah. And David, what about you? Summer movie performance.
Swiss Army Man's a really good choice. I think Tilda Swinton or Ralph Fiennes in A Bigger Splash, or Agnes Dean in Sunset Song, which if that came out at like the very beginning of May, I don't know if it qualifies.
It does. Anything after Captain America: Civil War counts.
Yeah, I mean, Agnes Dean in Summer Song might be the best performance of the year. Wow. So that.
Is that out on VOD yet? You probably not know.
No.
Will it ever be out on VOD? Who put that out?
Magnolia. Okay. Yeah,
It'll come. And I was going to give a shout out to Greta Gerwig in Wiener Dog, a movie that I really don't think anyone has seen for some reason, even though it's amazing. And I was also going to give a shout out to Chris Gethard in Don't Think Twice, Mike Birbiglia's movie, which you mentioned in the last segment. I just thought his performance was like really sensitive and heartbreaking and very funny. He's a comedian, and I don't think I've ever seen him act in anything, but he was excellent in this movie. So now for something completely different. What about the best summer action sequence, Dave?
Spider-Man versus Ant-Man for me. It might be a personal thing, but goddamn, worth it. I think I saw the movie like the third time just to see that sequence.
Dave, you know I was booing you in my heart.
I heard it in my heart.
I hope Ant-Man comes to high school in Spider-Man High School.
Part 3.
He'll be like a substitute teacher or something, some dinky scene where like he's like trying to get Spider-Man's attention.
Hey,
in front
it's
of the
me,
class.
Paul Rudd. How's it going?
Oh my God. I don't know. This was a the worst summer of all time for action sequences.
Really was.
I think that can be said with confidence. There was not a single competent one in an action movie. And we're talking like extreme levels of incompetence. Civil War is a crime against cinema. Fucking Jason Bourne. Paul Greengrass has gone off the reservation before, but like, Jesus Christ. Way to go to everyone who has like a aesthetic intolerance to what you do and effectively prove them right. What a disaster. I will say the fight in Kubo and the Two Strings with the sisters on the boat is probably number one. And like Ginger Rogers doing it backwards and in heels, does it in stop motion, which is incredible in its own right. Maybe makes some things a little bit easier, but is really beautifully choreographed.
Not water, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And very quickly, I pretty much agree with you, David. It's a bad, bad summer for action. But I'm going to give a shout out to The Purge Election Year, which opens with a very cool shootout with trying to protect the president or the president-elect candidate. I don't know. There's a lot of shooting, and it's terrifying. Terrifying action. So now, kind of the opposite of the spectrum, what was the most excruciating minute of a summer movie that you had to sit through this year? Dave?
I'm going to say the minute that Bruce Wayne is following Wonder Woman around the party for no reason.
That is a spring movie!
That's a spring movie?
It just feels like a
summer movie.
Oh, God,
but that
was
so bad. Okay, I'll pick a Suicide Squad moment because a lot of those moments
very
were goddamn painful. I'm going to say the completely cut up Joker Harlequin like helicopter encounter that where they just cheap out on the actual relationship.
Total nightmare. David?
I think that I will go with the first minute of Warcraft.
Oh.
Because that is when I knew that I was in for 120 more minutes of hell.
Gul'dan Baltus gives you a thumbs down with his orcish paw. Boo. Warcraft is the most criminally underrated summer movie.
You are... that's the most, if you ask me the most predictable thing of the summer, it's that Matt Patches would go to bat for fucking Warcraft.
But one movie I could not go to bat for was Independence Day Resurgence, which had the most excruciating minute of the summer for me, which was the battle. I don't know if people really saw this movie, but the climactic, quote-unquote, battle at the end where they fight a kaiju alien. Tedious, goofy, in the only way Roland Emmerich can construct character, and just totally convoluted. Awful,
if you ask me
awful.
The most forgettable movie of the summer.
Right, that would, right.
Because every time I hear of that movie, I'm reminded that it exists.
I don't think we'll be getting the third one where they go to the planet, sadly.
It's not good.
And let's just wrap up here with what is the studio movie specifically that we may still be talking about in a year from this summer, and why?
I think it's going to be interesting to hear if any of us have positive examples. But regardless on how all the pieces fall when the dust settles, I think we're going to be talking about Ghostbusters 2016 for a couple of different reasons.
I feel like there are positive reasons.
In my mind, there are positive reasons.
Not but, David's, but, you know.
I mean, I think it would be a big... If Sony were to step forward and decide to continue with the franchise, regardless, just out of principle, I think that would make it a talked about movie. And if they decide that, you know, good enough isn't enough for dealing with the online backlash, I think we'll be talking about that movie. So I think we'll be talking about that movie.
David?
I really do not think we're going to be talking about the movie. I don't think anyone talks about it even anymore. I think it was a disaster, and
you're supposed to have your own answer, not just talk about how my answer was wrong.
I know, but it's sad because, you know, I was saying my whole thing was, even if the movie's bad, we can't treat it like a referendum on female-driven comedies. And I'm not saying that's what we are doing, but of course that is what Hollywood will do. It's sort of inevitable, and it's upsetting. I think the movie that we will be talking about is Warcraft because of China. China, even though their box office is slipping a little bit, and there's rampant misreporting about fraud, right, about the box office numbers. The fact that Warcraft bombed so horribly in the United States, it was such a huge success in China, and will very, very likely get a sequel because of that, will be like the Pacific Rim 2 story times 20.
Well, look for my interview with Duncan Jones next week. You'll be very happy to. When I discuss the most criminally underrated movie of 2016 with Mr. Jones, and I'm gonna say Pete's Dragon. I mean, I think it was a big surprise for people. I think it's gonna be on my best movies of the year. I don't know if it'll crack a top 10, but I thought it was absolutely lovely. And I think people will go back to it, especially in the summer of Stranger Things. I feel like that is the biggest thing that happened pop culturally all summer, unfortunately. And when wiser people talk about nostalgia film and what the past can do for the present, we will talk about Pete's Dragon, and we'll wish more people had seen it in theaters. But
this
really
seems like a weird place to cross-pollinate. That's what we talked about on last week's Storm of Spoilers episode.
God,
if you want to check that out. Pete's Dragon, Stranger Things, nostalgia and storytelling. It's great.
Hey, we talked about a little bit on this podcast too, buddy.
Hey, all these podcasts are great.
They are all great. But really, in a year, we'll all be talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Civil War nonsense. And, you know how it is.
Yeah, where's Thanos? Nobody knows.
All right, for this week's third segment, we have a very special guest. He's been on the show before. You may know him as Rick the Intern from Draft Day. You may know him as that. You may know him as Casper from Vinyl, if you watch that show. You'll soon know him as Gavin on Search Party, a show I'm very excited to see that's coming to TBS. Am I right about that? Griffin Newman.
I feel like I haven't been introduced yet, so I don't know.
Griffin Newman.
Now, okay, yes, that is correct. It's coming to TBS, yes. Thanks for having me here.
For like a long
but
time.
There was already a really bad movie this year called Search Party. Do they have anything to do with each other?
No, and the annoying thing is that movie was shot like 4 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So it was on the shelf for so long that I wish they just kept on the shelf a little longer. Until
we all wish they had kept it on the shelf for longer, my friend.
Wait, yeah, well,
has First Party been like in the making for a while?
The TV show?
Yeah.
No, I think it came together pretty quickly. They shot the pilot last summer and then the season this, like early this year.
Gotcha. And these are the people from Fort Tilden, right? A movie that won South by Southwest at 2 years ago? I can't remember.
Yeah, yes, all of that is correct. Yeah, Fort Tilden was their NYU thesis film.
Oh.
And I was like a friend of theirs, and I had been in some of, not even like their short films, but like homework assignments. And so they asked me if I would be in it, which I thought like I was just doing them a favor. Because I was like, oh, this is like a student film. This is just like a fun thing. And then it won the Grand Jury Prize and led to me having like a multi-episode arc on a TV show. So the moral of the story is do favors for people.
Have friends do favors.
Yeah.
But that, I imagine this is not how you got your latest gig, which is The Tick, the Amazon pilot that's out there now, which is what we brought you on to really talk about. The Tick is actually written by the original guy who wrote The Tick, right? Give us the, what's the background on The Tick? Because yeah, this is third Tick, basically.
I think I've been saying this anytime I talk to people about the show, and no one's come up with a rival answer yet. But I think it is the only case in history where the guy who created a property has been behind this many reinterpretations of the property, you know? Usually people just keep doing the same thing, or if it gets rebooted, it gets rebooted by outside forces. But Ben Edlund, my savior and guru at this point in time, created The Tick as like a little like comic strip for his local comic store's newsletter when he was like 16 years old.
Right. It was basically his like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for all intents.
Exactly. Well, and then what happened was Ninja Turtles got so big that this comic book store decided they were going to start self-publishing like black and white underground comics because there was a big wave for that. So he was 19. He'd been doing the drawings for the newsletter. So they asked him to do an issue, and then it took off. He did 12 issues, and in the wake of now Ninja Turtles being so big on TV, everyone was scooping up any other Ninja Turtles-esque properties to turn to a cartoon show. So he like created the character when he was 16, was doing the comic when he was like 19 or 20, and then was like the showrunner on a Fox Kids Saturday morning show when he was like 24 or something, 25. He has a pretty insane, you know.
And he went on to do some big television shows or work with other people. I think
yeah,
he worked on like
yeah.
Firefly.
So the cartoon show ran for 3 years, and then sort of he worked a bunch of, jumped around for a bunch of other things, staffed on a bunch of other stuff, and then went to revive the show on Fox as the Warburton sitcom. And then when that ended, he sort of got pulled in by Joss Whedon and worked on Angel and worked on Firefly and then worked on Gotham and Supernatural and probably like seven other shows I'm forgetting, but has been working in like live action genre TV until this new version kind of came about.
Are we sure it's not Josh Whedon?
You mean the notorious Twitter account, Josh Whedon?
I don't know. That just sounds a lot more likable. Not in terms of like my affection for, a lot more likely, I should say. A lot more likely. That's what I'm looking for.
Are you suggesting, David, that we've all been mispronouncing and mistyping his name for years and he's too nice to correct us?
No, I think that it was
a misprint at Comic-Con years ago.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. And he was just like, the nerds love it. It's different. There's two S's in a row. It sounds like it could be auteurish, which is new for the television medium, and they ran with it. I don't know. I'm just saying there's something, there's a dirty secret there. People are saying.
I feel like it's like you're suggesting like a Steve Ranazzisi type, like boiling lie that just needs to be bust open by the New York Times.
Listen, I'm not saying anything.
Spotlight to Joss Whedon's real name.
Anyway, I think that was I took away the most important thing from the backstory that Griffin was giving us.
Well, to get us back on to get us back on track, Ben is also a co-executive producer on Powers, which I believe is on the PlayStation Network. So he's doing two like superhero riff shows at the same time. But yours is undoubtedly funnier.
Thank you. I think Powers
the show, Dave. I just want.
I think Powers just ended, but he was on for the second season. But he's just been sort of, a journeyman around the live action genre TV landscape. But for the last couple of years, has been sort of brewing this new version of The Tick, which is now out on Amazon. The pilot.
Now, here's the thing about The Tick. When I grew up, right, in Connecticut, I would get ticks, and my parents would have to take tweezers on, like, Sunday nights in summer and pull them wriggling out of my flesh, and then we would go for ice cream. And so I have always associated ticks with a negative thing. But then I watched this pilot, and it was a positive thing.
Have you ever had Lyme disease, David?
Not to my knowledge, but Lyme disease can be a fickle motherfucker. So you really
tick journalism is going on.
You
right
don't
here.
Know. So, but what happened between my experience with ticks and your experience with ticks that led us to this point where they're more positive?
Well, first of all, David, I have to say your questions are really, really on point in this interview. I mean, really probing, smart, interesting questions that are very much topical.
Not my job for nothing. Hey, ticks are topical, sort of by nature.
Yeah. Yes.
By nature.
You're nailing it. My mother had Lyme disease when I was growing up, and she had it for like a. Yeah, right. She had it for like a. This is also an exclusive. You're scooping this. No one else has gotten
this. I see this in the character on the show, anyway.
Right. No, the first time my family and I went to Disney World, my mother, we had like booked the trip a long time in advance and planned it out, and then my mother got Lyme disease, and by the time we had the trip in place, she was like so hobbled that she had spent most of her time in bed. So it was like my dad, my brother, and I running around Disney World. And at the end of each day, we'd come back to the hotel where my mother would be just lying in bed awake with the lights off in a hotel room. Dark. And on the last day, she had the energy to do like one day of rides and stuff. And we pushed my mom around in a wheelchair.
But some would say that's like the best way to experience Disney World. One day, which is plenty, and also in a wheelchair.
Well, you get to skip all the lines.
Oh, there you go.
That was the thing. It was like however many days of my dad and I. What were you saying? Sorry.
I know. I'm just gonna say. So it's what you're saying to me is that you've actually always, or at least you, like in your family, there's been a positive association with ticks from the beginning.
It's been great because we were able to skip all the lines at Disney World, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And you brought that to every sea of The Tick. Well, let me ask you, because you know, I think people who listen to this show read a lot of interviews with different actors, and they kind of talk. I don't know, the whole getting into a show and or launching a show is such a mysterious process, mostly because it might be kind of mundane. But I don't think anyone listening to this would think that your experience of landing a gig like this after, you know, your Twitter presence, you've done some smaller films and television roles, and this is like a big deal that you're on The Tick. So I'm curious about, like, what were you doing?
Is this the biggest deal? Is this your biggest deal so far?
It's like a big deal.
This is the biggest deal to me, at least. I mean, it feels like it is, you know.
I mean, you were in a Kevin Costner movie, so that's a big deal too, but.
Yeah. I mean, this is like, you know, more weight being thrown on my shoulders, and then also like the history of the property and a character that's been around for a long time. But
you are the lead. I mean, like, at least in this pilot, I understand that the show is called The Tick, but it's clear that A, you will play a pivotal
He's
role
the emotional core.
Moving forward. But in this pilot, which is all that exists in the show so far, you are the lead.
Yeah, I liken it to like Beetlejuice, you know, where like Beetlejuice is the title character because he's like the biggest presence, but he's more of a sort of looming force. And then I'm some combination of Gina Davis, Alec Baldwin, and Winona Ryder.
And you look at
it. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Were you on vinyl when you heard about The Tick, or like, how, do you have to chase these roles? You're still going to auditions. This is a big deal, and you're prepping for that while doing other work. What was the situation when you heard about The Tick?
Yeah, this was definitely a chase. I mean, I'll be honest. I was kind of in a point where I was getting a little frustrated with acting, less with doing it as like a form of creative expression, but more of just the hustle of everything. And also the lack of control you have over your career. Because it was, you know, I was getting disillusioned by a lot of things I was working on that I wasn't happy with. Not vinyl, which I had a really good experience working on. And I was sort of in this mindset where was like, well, if Vinyl gets picked up for another season, I kind of want to like not audition as much because I'll have that sort of job security playing this very small part in a series that, you know, at least will offer some sort of regular work. And so I was sort of auditioning passively, waiting for Vinyl to get picked up so I could say to my agents, like, well, I have a job, you know, I'll make you money. Don't put me up for anything else. And The Tick was like the last thing that came in right before Vinyl got a season two pickup. And it was like, oh, this is the one thing I would actually want to do. Because I was auditioning for a lot of pilots that I thought were garbage. And it was like, well, I'm a big fan of The Tick. And then I read the script and I thought the script was great. And it was obviously like a big part, an exciting part, and a lot of stuff that I felt like people hadn't given me the chance to show I could do before. So they didn't have a casting person in New York. I had to like self-tape with my manager's assistant, which is usually, it feels kind of like throwing pennies down a wishing well.
Who is Ian McKellen, by the way. So you had a good actor.
My manager's assistant is Ian McKellen, which helped a lot.
It's huge.
Yeah, but I self-taped, and then, you know, the casting director, who's sort of been a supporter of mine in the past, even though we hadn't even met at that point, just she had liked the times I had sent tapes into her in the past, wrote me back and said, like, I think you can do better than this, which is one of the best things anyone's ever done in my life, because that's sort of the big disadvantage of self-taping over auditioning in person, is if you audition in person, they give you notes, and you try it a couple different ways. And if you self-tape, you get to try it different ways, but you're only going to send them one thing, and they don't get a sense of who you are in the room, whatever. So she gave me some notes, and I did a second tape, and then they got back to me and said that Ben Edlin wanted to meet with me.
What was her note? What was her note to you? Being better is not a note. You would
I'll give you
such direction.
Here's the actual note. It was ironic because it was the only time I've gotten this note in my entire life. But I, the day I was taping the thing, and I really wanted this part. I thought there was no way I was going to get it, but I wanted to at least put my best foot forward to give it the best shot. And I'm a very neurotic, anxious person in general, which is kind of the cornerstone of this character. And I went in to do the tape, and I felt so fucking calm that day for some reason. It was like the most psychologically even-keeled I have felt in my entire life. And I was like downing coffee trying to make myself more anxious, but nothing was working. And I sent the tape in, and she said, and you know, there's a part of acting and auditioning or whatever where you just go, like, you just have to do your best and then walk away from it. You know, I knew I was kind of forcing it that day, but it was like, well, I can't drive myself crazy about this. And she emailed back and she said, I don't know if this sounds weird, but it feels like you're trying to seem nervous rather than actually seeming nervous. And I was like, I got that. I can do it again. I'll actually be nervous today. So I did the take where I was actually nervous, sent that to her. They emailed me back, said that Ben wanted to meet with him. We got coffee and sort of just talked generally about stuff. And then they told me that I was his top choice. But then even from that point on, there was like a month of sort of jumping through hoops because he had to convince everyone one by one to cast a largely, you know, violently unknown actor.
Violently unknown to
be the guy like carrying his show, you know. And so then it ultimately came down to like one final screen test I had, which was very much stated to me as like, well, this is yours to lose. Like, everyone wants you to get this part, and if you don't do well today, we go back to the drawing board.
Doesn't it seem like that always happens, though? You always hear stories of people who are on the verge of rethinking their career in acting when the part ends up defying them, comes along.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest career advice I would give to anyone is retire. Because I was like right on the verge of stepping away from it, and that's when this happened. So I'd say retiring is probably the best thing that can happen to your career. You know, I had the email draft ready to go, and then both search party and this happened.
So you go out to L.A. to shoot this, or did you guys shoot it in New York?
We shot it all in New York, yeah.
As it looks. It looks
like you shot at Silver Cup Studios in Queens, but I would
no, it looks that. It looks very New York-y. I vaguely remember you going out to L.A. for something. I couldn't remember if that was to do some like very convincing studio work on
the
show.
Oh, wait. You were digitally mapped for this show, right? Didn't they?
That is true. Yeah, the L.A. stuff was all that sort of stuff. They did like a head scanning and then table reads and that screen test and then – costume fittings, that all that stuff was in LA. Yeah, the scanning was pretty nuts because they have to. I have this high tech helmet in the pilot that they had to, you know, rather than doing those horrible like mummification head casts, they now just like have a medical bone density scanner, and they like swab across your face, and then yeah, it's a digital griffin in a computer, and they sculpt it on top of that.
So if you die, we could still do the show. Hey, there's a digital you somewhere. Okay.
Yeah,
just to be clear.
I think 3D printing has to advance a little bit for it to be seamless, but they could make a decent facsimile.
We have a Lego version of you that will definitely stand in.
Yeah.
So you shoot it here. How was the actual process of doing that? Because, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, for all the things that you've done so far, this feels like, at least from where I'm sitting, like it must have been the most exaggerated in terms of like how surreal it was. You're in this crazy costume for at least a little bit of the episode. You're walking around with Peter Serafinowicz, who's in a very crazy costume the whole episode. Was it a different experience than even working with Martin Scorsese?
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, a lot of that is just like the responsibility that was placed on my shoulders. You know, I mean, being around a set that was that heightened and looking around it, and there were, you know, I'd have to work my hardest to like turn this off, but it was very hard not to think like, oh, if I don't do a good job, this entire thing is fucked, you know? Whereas like when I was working with Scorsese on Vinyl, it's like I'm the smallest part of this thing. They could cut me out. Like I'm almost always the least important element of any shot I'm in, you know? And this was like, I mean,
they
can
fix you in
like,
post.
Yeah, 100%. And this was a case where that would be very, very expensive. So it was, yeah, it's crazy doing scenes with guys in a dude in a superhero costume. You know, it's crazy being on a set that has like stunts and stuff going on. But there is a degree of like, you know, the nuts and bolts of actual filmmaking kind of feel the same, whether it's a superhero pilot or like a student film or a web series or whatever it is, you know? At the end of the day, it's still about the same thing of just like trying to figure out how to not fuck up.
Point A to point B.
Right. It's all just about walking from point A to point B.
I know, actually.
But there was a scene where I'm running away from the cops, and they said, like, you know, I think Ben came over to me and said, like, you know, that's impressive how quickly you're like mustering up all that fear. It really feels like you're scared. And I said, do you want to know my trick? And he said, yeah. And I said, I just look around and remember that there are millions of dollars on the line and I have the ability to fuck it all up. And that was like my acting key for any of the times I need to be nervous on the show.
Job keeps you neurotic. That's really
yes,
funny.
100%. Yeah.
Now, did you ask, because I had asked you, I don't know if you remember this. I don't know if these words actually came out of my mouth. I think they did. To get to the bottom of one of cinema's enduring mysteries, which was whether Peter Serafinowicz's character in Spy was actually Italian or just pretending for his cover.
You have asked me this out loud. Okay. My friend and podcast co-host David Sims the other day was trying to remember who it was that asked that. I haven't yet, and I will say that is so there is incentive for everyone to vote on the show on Amazon.com so we can get a season.
I want it in oral writing here.
Yes.
If the show gets picked up, I want an answer.
Unquestionably, yes. Okay. I will get him on camera answering that question. Should we get a full season, I get to keep working with
them. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
So tell us about the process with the voting. I know the Tick is a big fan base, so I'm not too surprised to see, quality aside, that it has a lot of votes in this Amazon process, especially compared to the two other pilots that it's competing against. But what does that mean? What is the metric that's used?
Well, the most votes, David, wins.
Well, I don't know if it's that simple. I don't know.
No. It's actually, yeah, it's not that simple. I mean, the thing is, it's less of like a sort of kind of didactic like a competition than it is sort of like a very, yeah, yeah. No, it's like a sort of crowdsourced focus group, you know? I mean, the idea is that like historically networks have made pilots and they pick like 10 random people out of a mall and have them watch and see if they like it. And then a bunch of executives turn their thumbs up or down, decide whether or not it goes. But you're not really getting a good sample size. especially now that we're in like a, you know, sort of fractured media culture where you're not trying to make something that everyone will like. You're trying to make something that some people will love passionately. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully, you know, as many people as you can like it, but it, you know, we're not trying to make I Love Lucy anymore. Right. So the idea is you put the thing out there and you see how many people organically find it. You see how they respond, how they rate it, you know, the surveys, social media, reviews, I mean, all of that. So all three pilots could potentially go that were, you know, posted up. It's not a competition in that sense. And it's just sort of them being able to accrue the data. And there's not like a quota we need to hit on any one number. So it's definitely, it's been good so far, which, you know, as you said, like, the fact that the Tick does have a built-in audience was gave us some comfort in the fact that, like, well, people are going to watch it the first couple days no matter what. But it also meant that the people who would watch it in the first couple days are the people who would hate it the most if anyone was going
to
hate it.
That's my big question, kind of to ramp up here, Griffin. Yeah. I'm curious about talking to Ben about the show because there's been two iterations of the Tick, one animated, one live action. What was his like feeling going into it? Like, how is this going to be different, and how are you kind of clicking into those reasons that it's going to be fresh, it's going to be new, and it's going to be doing something different, even though it's still going to be kind of the classic Tick vibe?
Yeah, I think you know, a lot of it is like the changing of the media landscape. So a, the fact that like you know, the original the Tick comic book was sort of satirizing what was big in comic books at the time, which was like the Frank Miller stuff, especially like his Daredevil run and Ninja Turtles, and that sort of like sort of grittier, more self-serious kind of thing. And then the cartoon show was sort of satirizing the X-Men cartoon and the Spider-Man cartoon and Batman the Animated Series and the other superhero cartoon shows that were on at the time. But when they did the live-action Warburton show, it was like, you know, the year after the first X-Men movie came out and the year before the first Spider-Man movie came out. So you were sort of right before the, like, superhero onslaught began and then never ended. So there wasn't really much of a cultural reference base in terms of, like, live-action superhero stuff. You know, you had, like, the Batman movies and the Superman movies, which were both sort of dormant at that point. And so that show is much more of like a sitcom about superheroes, you know, and it's dealing with superficial superheroes on a more sort of superficial aesthetic level. And I think it's a really, really funny show. But Ben is like very into sort of going deep in a layered way and sort of being able to tell these larger mythological stories while satirizing the things. So I think, A, he saw that the change in the superhero landscape and how pervasive it had become and how much it had shifted around now to a sort of more self-serious, gritty thing closer to those comics. That's what the movies had become now. And there was some, there was a lot of comedic tension to be mined out of placing the Tick into that environment, you know, kind of keeping the Tick the same, but putting him in something that feels like the Marvel Netflix shows. Well,
there's kind of an Alan Moore vibe to this Tick pilot that is it reminds me of this book Top 10. I'm not sure if you've ever read but it's very funny, but it's also, there's obviously some serious shit going on in the world of the Tick. And you have Wally Pfister, who shot Nolan's Batman movies, and that's he's a serious guy. I don't know if he's a funny guy. He shot Flaked for Netflix.
Crack a lot of jokes about transcendence.
You see my Johnny Depp computer movie?
You're joking, but yes, like 100%. I mean, he's the first guy to make transcendence jokes.
Really?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And he's also, he is like a very funny kind of avuncular guy. I mean, I feel like I just assumed, much like you guys did, because he worked with Nolan, and the Nolan aesthetic is so sort of like crisp and clean and didactic and like clinical and whatever, that he was going to be like that. But he's like this, hey, man, how's it going? Kind of like surfer, like aging rock star kind of guy. And I think he felt like, you know, doing something like this was closer to his sensibility than transcendence maybe, which was sort of what people expected him to do. I don't want to talk for him, but like you meet him and you sort of get exactly why he would want to do this show, because it's like, well, he does have this aesthetic background and understanding how to make these sort of very iconic, dramatic superhero images, but his sensibility is much closer to the Tick than Transcendence.
Yeah, Transcendence could have used some jokes. They could have used Griffin Newman a computer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's Transcendence.
Well, now you
too.
Have that.
Yeah, exactly.
A computer now somewhere in LA. So,
but that's, I mean, an answer, long answer to your question. I think that was the other element, in addition to sort of being able to satirize how much superhero culture has changed. Also, the idea of being able to do a Tick because of how TV shows work now and that it is more serialized. Do one that had, you know, the Saturday morning cartoon show, most of the episodes sort of stood independently. Right. And the Warburton show was more of like a sitcom where it reset every episode. And he wanted to do one that had a larger, sort of more deliberate, involved story, which is what the comics were like. And so, in his mind, the way to do that was to make Arthur sort of the emotional core of the show, because you don't want to disrupt the Tick and stop him from being sort of this oblivious force in nature.
So when do you find out whether or not there's another episode of the Ticks and, you know, more behind it, presumably?
I think the Amazon's window is 30 days, so it's going to be up on their site until September 19th while they continue sort of aggregating all this data. And then I think we'll have an answer pretty soon after that. But it would hopefully be like next summer it would be dropping. You know, they'd start writing shortly after that, and we'd film at the beginning of the new year, and then it would come out maybe late next summer, maybe like a year from now.
We'd have And worst comes to worst, let's say for whatever reason the show does not happen, are you more confident in committing to acting than you were before? Are you still going to maybe, you know, slum it through some auditions and tough it out? Or
no, I'm retiring again.
You're retired. So in order to save your career, full stop. I have to
retire again. Yeah. No, I mean, I feel like, we're talking like just a couple days after this thing dropped. And so I'm still sort of waiting to see the full, like, long tail, like, reaction that this thing causes. But it does feel like, you know, a lot of the frustration as an actor is being like, I have so little control over my career and there are things I think I can do, but I'm not getting the opportunities. And, you know, it feels self-centered to feel bitter about that, but it's also a very frustrating position to be in. And I feel like regardless of what happens next, there's like a 30-minute pilot that was made where they let me be the lead of a superhero TV show and carry a lot of weight and play a lot of different colors. And so I feel like a sense of like comfort in like, well, I showed what I did. You know, I got to show, I think, a lot of what I felt I hadn't been able to show up until now.
Worst comes to worst, you could always play the role that the guy from Silicon Valley played in Spy 2 as the henchman who gets his throat disintegrated.
Right. That's my backup plan. Yeah. For the time being, I feel like I have a really good reel now, which is just sending that pilot to everybody.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here. I thought the Tick was very enjoyable, and I had, other than liking Patrick Warburton and hating Ticks, so it really could have gone either way. I came down quite positively on this. I would love to see more episodes. So if you're listening to the show, please go on Amazon, watch the show, vote for it.
And Griffin, where can people find you on the internet if they want to follow for all the Tick updates?
They can find me. I'm Griff Lightning, LLIGHTNING. Sometimes people misspell it and make it Griff Lighting, like I'm a lighting company.
Grease Lightning, sorry.
Yeah, it's like Grease Lightning, but with Griff. And then that's my handle on all the social media platforms. And then my podcast is Blank Check with Griffin and David, which two of you three gentlemen have been on, and the third one will be on when he's in New York City.
Yes, I have to corporeally travel.
Please come.
I can't transcend, apparently.
Get into a computer immediately.
I'll talk to Wally. We'll see if we can figure something out.
Yeah, it'll be great. I need to shave my head and get some wire implants. I was planning to do that already.
Yeah.
You do kind of look like that. Griffin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, guys.
Thanks,
real
Griffin.
Pleasure.
The earth is on fire. We don't have no daughter.
Let the motherfucker burn.
All right, that's it for this week's XXL Fighting in the War Room episode. Thank you to Griffin Newman for joining us and giving us insight into the world of Tick. Thank you, Dave and David, for giving me your answers to my crazy summer questions. And thank you to everyone listening for putting up with it. Where can we find you guys on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, because that's my name, Dave Gonzalez. I also blog at geek.com. And you could find all my podcasts at fightinginthewarroom.com. That includes this one. And also this week on Star Wars Spoilers, we're going to cover all of the Laika films, including Kubo and the Two Strings, which was fucking beautiful.
Yeah, it was.
But we're going to have a throwdown about which one the best is. And it's really a toss-up between Kubo and Paranorman for me. So, you know, tune in. Yell at your earphones when we pick Ron.
I'm David Ehrlich. I am the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on the internet at where am I? David Ehrlich. And wait, I'm tired. And you can find all of us together on the Facebook Fighting in the War Room.
And I am Matt Patches, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. I'm the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com, and we are on Twitter at FITWR, where you can message us any of your thoughts about this episode. We usually communicate with you. It's amazing. Or you can even tweet our handle at other people you know who don't listen at this show to remind them that they should be listening to this show. I think it's a great idea. You can also answer this week's lightning round question, which is,
in honor of the mechanic resurrection, what is a sequel no one asked for that turned out to be relatively enjoyable?
Until next week, farewell.